Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? He kinda does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find How to Do Everything now at iTunes.com/NPR. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll visit the new space fantasy Jupiter Ascending, even though many people didn't. And we'll talk about the elusive matter of chemistry. Who has it, what makes it, and how to get it. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is our friend Chris Klimek. Chris, when you are not appearing on Pop Culture Happy Hour, what do you do?
I'm a writer and editor at Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine and a contributor to various blogs, none of them mightier than your own Monkey See.
There you go. Well, Chris is with us in part because Chris is a guy who can appreciate a big movie. Mm-hmm. And I think it's safe to say that the Wachowskis' Jupiter Ascending is a big movie. It is big in output. It is big in scale. It was not particularly big in weekend box office. Mm-hmm. I am very, very curious to hear how people reacted to this movie because it has taken a critical drubbing, with some exceptions. It has taken a Twitter drubbing. There has been a bit of a social media pylon, I would say. And I am very curious to hear what some of you thought. And I am getting a lot of face from Glenn. So I want to ask Glenn.
Well, Glenn, who predicted that this movie would make $200 million.
That's right. That was his...
That was one of your New Year's
That was one of his 2015 predictions.
Yep.
So
yep.
It does not necessarily look like the prediction is going to come true.
There's still time. There's still time.
I'm like Homer with the pig.
It's still good. It's still good. It's
what was the face price of your ticket to Jupiter Ascending?
Here's the thing. It made $19 million this weekend.
But it also there's also worldwide box office.
Sure, but I only counted.
Said domestic.
I did say domestic. So it made $19 million this last weekend. So that means it's only, to hit my prediction, it's only about $181 million to go. So mm-hmm. you figure $10 average ticket price, if 18.1 million of you go pretty soon, it's not going to be in theaters very long. So that means 18.1 million of you go next weekend, we can still pull this thing out. This was not the gorgeous fiasco that I wanted it to be. It was also not a secret, surprising masterpiece. It is, as Chris's review in The Dissolve and several other reviews said, it falls somewhere in the middle. It's a really ambitious, goofy, but cheerfully goofy, I would say, space opera. And I have lots more to say about it and a lot more to say about the criticism it's received, but I think we should hear from some other folks first.
All right. Chris, what did you think of it?
So the way I set up my review was thinking about The Matrix, the film that introduced most of us to the Wachowskis, which came out in the spring of 1999 when everybody who cares about science fiction was looking forward to The Phantom Menace. Mm. The Matrix was not even on anybody's radar, and I was thinking about how exactly the same amount of time has passed since The Matrix as passed between Return of the Jedi and this Star Wars movie, The Phantom Menace, and the Wachowskis are now in essentially the position that George Lucas was in at that time, where they've gone from being these scrappy little agitators who are going to change the system, man, to being kind of the system. I mean, it's not a direct one-to-one comparison. They don't work for themselves the way George Lucas was able to arrange. They're not paying for their own movies themselves.
they're eccentric billionaires.
Yeah.
I don't think George Lucas had had the string of intervening movies that people had a lot of questions about.
Speed Racer, Cloud Atlas.
I mean, they wrote V for Vendetta, rumored to have directed some of it. They produced some things. I know they're doing a Netflix series now. So, I mean, they've kind of branched out into other areas beyond just directing in the way that Lucas did. I mean, it's a comparison. It's not an identical
position. I'm going with you, Chris Klimek.
I still think of them as those agitators. So I have this knee-jerk position of wanting to root for them. And I don't know that this movie is that ambitious. I mean, other than the fact that it's not based on a pre-existing, you know, YA series or comic book or whatever, it's kind of an original in the air quotes that we have to put around original.
Sure.
And that it is, you know, jury-rigged from derivative elements from many, many more compelling things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just kind of a bummer.
I had a little bit of a different reaction, but it's hard to say to people, you know what? Okay, it's not very good, but you should see it. And that's kind of how I felt about this movie. This is a very earnest movie. I mean, and the Wachowskis are like that. Cloud Atlas is a big, messy, earnest movie. But Cloud Atlas, in many spots, is also boring.
Yep.
This is not boring, but it has that element of it is, to me, a big swing, which was a term that Linda used when we talked about Interstellar. It's like, that was a great big swing, whether you thought it connected or not. And this is also a great big swing. It's not necessarily profound, but it's going for that. It's got some bigger ideas, and yet it doesn't do what I was terrified it was going to do, which was be 2 hours of space exposition.
Right.
That it was going to be 2 hours of world building, and we were going to learn about this society and its war with this other society, kind of a la John Carter, where which I found very frustrating in that way. The first chunk of it is pretty inscrutable, where you're trying to figure out exactly how she's gotten into this situation. To me, I still don't exactly have a perfect handle on it. Once they have set up, okay, now space chase, go.
Right. Let's explain a little bit what this movie's about. So Mila Kunis is a young woman who cleans houses for a living. She meets up with Channing Tatum, who is part man, part wolf dog, I believe.
Right.
And he's a former soldier. And they get embroiled in a gigantic space royal power struggle involving three siblings. You have the two brothers and the sister. Eddie Redmayne is, the other two are sort of naturalistic.
Uh-huh.
And then Eddie Redmayne is doing this hilarious. He's doing this hilarious.
I create life and I destroy it.
Oh, it's so that is uncanny.
You'd be surprised how spot on.
I hope at the Oscars, Eddie Redmayne and Steve Carell find a room together and they can just get together and have a strangled whisper off.
I destroy life.
And Steve Carell would be like, you have psychological problems.
It was Matt Patches on Twitter who suggested that he needs to be the third brother of Hans Gruber and Simon Gruber from Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Sure.
I said Willis versus Redmayne would be a whisper off, murmur off.
Except kind of more so. I mean, what he is doing in this movie as kind of the space opera bad guy is just huge.
Big.
Huge big. And I feel like the thing I like about that performance is that he is so in it.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that for a lot of this movie, Mila Kunis is pretty committed to playing this girl as like a regular girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've put her into this movie with Eddie Redmayne, who is this bizarre, overclocked villain. And then in the middle, you have Channing Tatum, who can relate to her as kind of a normal person. This is the whole like splice thing, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of the bridge between this normalcy of her and this giganticness of this Eddie Redmayne performance. Here's the thing. I think it's because I saw it in the recliner theater. This happened.
Four stars. Four stars to comfort.
This happened when I saw The Boy Next Door. I was like, I don't think it was that bad. I say this as someone who found Cloud Atlas in particular interminable.
Mm-hmm.
What I liked about Jupiter Ascending, and this is a little different from what Steven was saying, is that I don't think it has that many bigger ideas.
Right.
I think Jupiter Ascending is mostly a space adventure where Dog Boy and Earth Girl meet, and then they battle, and there are chase scenes, and there is an early chase in Chicago involving Mila Kunis and Channing Tatum, which I thought was actually pretty good, and which I thought, this reminds me of why people have sometimes really been drawn to the way that the Wachowskis shoot tactile fighting and stuff like that. It involves the dude like running off and the woman like hanging on, which is such a setup for me to be bored out of my skull. But I actually thought it was pretty interesting.
But he is skating across the sky. He's not straight up flying.
Yeah.
So visually, it's a little bit different.
He's got rocket boots and like an invisible shield that he mostly uses to womp people.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's a lot of futuristic weaponry and space womping.
And it's not It's not over long. Mm-hmm. It's not 3 hours of this, as I feared.
Just cannot believe that I'm going to be the least enthusiastic on this movie of the four of us.
It's kind of crazy.
It is Guardians of the Galaxy without the awesome mix and without the jokes to me, and that's.
I think that's true to a point. But Linda, you were disagreeing with me about ideas, and I'm not saying this is an incredibly profound movie. I didn't find myself moved by it in any of the places I was supposed to be moved by it. There are a lot of visual ideas in it, and there's a lengthy scene involving space bureaucracy. It's basically like steampunk bureaucracy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true.
And you know, on which more money was spent than I will ever have in my entire life put together. That's a fascinating idea, and it's executed in an interesting way with lots and lots of ideas in the set decoration.
Exactly. They know this about world building, which is that you assert a thing, you don't explain it. Mm-hmm. You assert and you move on. And that set piece is a weird, very idiosyncratic little sequence that doesn't feel like it necessarily belongs in this movie, but it's there anyway. It features a Terry Gilliam cameo in case you missed what was going on there.
Yeah.
It's one thing to critique its execution. And there's plenty to critique here. I mean, we're going to talk about chemistry in a bit. I don't happen to think these two leads have it. But
I think Channing Tatum has more chemistry with Jonah Hill than he does with Mila Kunis.
In a lot of the criticism that I was reading, it was not so much critiquing its execution as resenting its existence.
Yeah.
Now, I was guilty of this a little bit when I kind of came in here on that other podcast and we talked about it, and I just ticked off the plot such as it is and was goofing on it because it is goofy. But, I mean, I kept reading stuff like, jet boots, family of space, and like the queen of space. And it's like, well, you are not reacting to this movie. You're reacting to science fiction. You're reacting to the genre. That is a reflexive thing. Look, I was a proud member of the science fiction book club for most of my adolescence. I was actually a pretty sheepish member because I didn't tell anybody about it, but I devoured hundreds and hundreds of just schlocky science fiction. And these tropes are part of it. And you're right, Chris, it doesn't necessarily feel that original. It's just mixing things from different parts, different tropes together, but welcome to genre. That's what you do. You take a lot of different things and you mix them together in a new way that doesn't feel like anything else. This notion that we have to kind of be like, and so he's a half dog? Come on. That's like going to a Western and being, oh, what? So the cops ride horses now? Is that what's going on here?
Or the musical objection that you talk about. They're going to sing the story to each other?
And I've talked about that with fantasy, where I said, I try not to critique things that are part of a genre by not liking things that are what that genre is.
Absolutely. And it's just a refusal to engage with genre. It's another example of this sort of anti-genre bias. But I sat there looking at a giant spaceship, you know, bending the size of a continent, bending space-time around it, going warp, 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 and seeing that scene you were talking about with a jack guy in jet boots, you know, who's a half-dog albino with a gun that goes pew, 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 fighting a Asian chick on a hover bike. Let me say that again, a hover bike. And I just had a big dopey grin on my face throughout this entire movie.
I think that's sort of how I reacted. Like, I felt like it was the last thing I expected it to be, which was light.
Right.
And I appreciated that.
I think that's a good way of putting it. It's not funny. Mm-mm. It's not.
Not usually.
There
was one joke that landed with the audience that I saw.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't know. I mean, breezy sounds like more humor filled than it is. But it does have a quality to it. Like, and let's go back for a moment to Eddie Redmayne. We all watched Man of Steel. I think, Chris, you were here on the podcast when we talked about Man of Steel.
I was.
And I, if you recall, I hated that movie.
I was here in this corner with my hands up.
You were in a defensive crouch the entire time.
You guys were wailing on my ribs.
As I pummeled and pummeled and pummeled. Mm-hmm. On that movie, which I really detested. And that's a very portentous, unpleasant movie. And it has in it a performance by Michael Shannon as General Zod, who is wildly chewing scenery. Mm-hmm. And this Eddie Redmayne performance has... It's like he's like a splice of General Zod and somebody who is inexplicably crying.
Yeah.
You mentioned like, oh, he's loud. He's either shouting or he's very quiet. His quiet acting is louder than his loud acting.
Yep, it's true.
But I don't necessarily think like it's clearly not an acting decision made by Eddie Redmayne. It's clearly the Wachowskis' vision for what this wackadoo character is supposed to be like, and that's just fun. And it felt different.
At worst, it's his interpretation of what he thinks belongs in this movie. And I sort of agreed with him. I think that is what belongs in this movie. What are you going to have? More?
Yeah.
You wanted more from Eddie Redmayne.
I wanted more of
Did you want
Eddie
him to
Redmayne.
Open a vein?
I wanted more of Eddie Redmayne.
Oh, more of. And I thought you meant from. I was like, what more can he do? Did you see the movie?
It's pretty big.
So when people talk about what Star Wars did to movies over the course of almost 40 years now is not just skewing everything younger, but also taking what would have been B pictures before and making those the projects that all the money got funneled into. And in a weird way, I was watching those grand cosmic vistas of the ships warping in front of the gas giant and stuff and kind of wondering how I could be bored through all this. And there is part of me that really wants to see, like, the $15 million version of this movie, because in the first part of it, I actually had this sort of reaction to this that Linda had to Interstellar, where I was much more with it while they were on Earth than when they go and spend the rest of the movie in front of a green screen. When we could see that Chicago skyline, I felt a little more grounded in it. But certain scenes, like the fertility clinic thing, where Mila Kunis is there being violated by little green men or gray men, I think, disguised as the human staff of the, were just weird enough that they had me thinking of movies like Repo Man or or a movie that I think this references explicitly, like The Matrix does actually, The Terminator, which was a little $6 million movie about a waitress who turns out to be the savior of the world. So this time it's Mila Kunis as a house cleaner.
Yeah.
But those movies actually get something in charm from their low rent aesthetic, I think, that this movie is too expensive to
ask. This is not a scruffy movie.
It's not, but I tell you, I'm sitting there and I'm seeing these effects, which are great with a couple exceptions, and I was just so grateful the effort had gone into making this that we were matching doubling down on money plus weirdness. I like that thing, because otherwise you get stock stuff and cheap special effects and you get the Sci-Fi Channel. And I was so grateful that this film hadn't been made on the Sci-Fi Channel and that we were actually taking a look at some very interesting ideas that, again, just get tossed off. Like, you know, in Star Wars, when Han Solo says, it's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs, we don't stop and go, well, what's a Kessel Run? Explain to me what the Kessel Run. And we don't. And why did you say parsecs? Because that's a measurement of time and not about it. Anyway, it just goes. It just happens. And there's so many things, little ideas hanging around the edges of the screen that you never really kind of fully engage. And I kind of like that because that's world building.
I don't think it's a terrific movie. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say like, oh my gosh, you're really going to regret it if you don't see it.
Yeah, this isn't Edge of Tomorrow. We're not sitting here begging people to go see it before it leaves theaters.
But no.
I sort of am.
Well, Glenn is for different reasons.
But I think it is not as unsuccessful as its press. Mm-hmm. I would definitely go that far.
I still want the Wachowskis to get their projects funded. Like, I'm still interested in what
they're
doing. And I feel like their misses far outnumber their hits at this point, but I still care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's basically right. Well, the numbers would suggest that not a terribly large number of you may have seen this movie, but some of you undoubtedly did. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at NPRPCHH. So the other thing we were going to talk about this week, is a topic near and dear to my heart in running this show here, because we're talking about chemistry. Now, the way that we got on this topic was in part, this is where we gracefully weave in the thing that we're not going to talk about this week, which is 50 Shades of Grey. There have been wild rumors circulating that the stars of 50 Shades of Grey, who you would think would have other things to worry about, hate each other. And which is funny because, I don't know if you've heard, but there's sex in that movie because there's sex in that book. I don't know, again, if you've heard. So we became curious about the entire idea, whether or not those rumors are true in this particular case. We became curious about the entire idea of chemistry, both romantic and platonic, and how it's created and how important it is. I am the designated rom-com liker in this group. You might expect me to be the person with the most thoughts, but often I'm not the person with the most thoughts. So I'm going to go to the man that I call the man with the most thoughts. My best friend, Stephen Thompson.
That is ladies and gentlemen, internationally known around the world,
internationally known thought haver, Stephen Thompson.
So Thompson, when we put this topic out there, what did it bring to mind for you?
I think that chemistry, like physical chemistry between stars who are playing lovers, is overrated. Mm-hmm. And that it is often the product of good acting and good writing in ways that I think get underrepresented when people talk about chemistry. So much of chemistry between lovers or people who are dating in movies is based on movement in the script and pacing by the director and the editor, and in ways that make it so that, for example, Channing Tatum and Mila Kunis in Jupiter Ascending do not have great romantic chemistry.
Nope.
You know that she's attracted to him because she looks at him and then says she's attracted to him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's and because you just kind of expect it because he's going around saving her.
And it feels kind of out of nowhere when it goes from subtext to text. You kind of feel like it wasn't subtext.
Right.
It's like all of a sudden it's just text.
Exactly. And then Chris made the point that Channing Tatum has this great chemistry with Jonah Hill in 21 Jump Street. That is comic timing, part of good acting, and snappy direction. I'm not sloughing off the topic entirely, but I would just put it out there that I think elements of attraction, you have all these cases of real life couples exhibiting no on-screen chemistry. Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez in Gigli, mm-hmm, is generally considered a movie in which these two people have zero romantic chemistry. I'm guessing they had romantic chemistry in their lives, but there were other problems with that movie.
You know, it's not ephemeral. It's not lightning in a bottle. It's very easy to tell whether or not two actors have chemistry, and I'm going to tell you how. In Michael Caine's old book, In Videotape, Acting on Film, which is a very practical guide to exactly that, he talks about how when you're in a two-shot with another actor, when people get close, they tend to have their gaze, their vision, kind of jump from one eye to the next on the other person's face. And that is something that the camera picks up and magnifies and makes the actor seem untrustworthy and shifty. So he says, when you're in a two-shot, look at only one of the other person's eyes, the eye that is farthest away from the camera, and you will have a steady gaze and people will trust you. Similarly, related, when you are attracted to somebody, your eyes make these small micro movements all the time, especially as you get closer and closer together. My theory is that you're just confronted with this thing you just want to drink in.
Yeah.
And your eyes just kind of keep darting around. And if it's perfect facial symmetry, as it often is with movie stars, just roving around looking for a flaw. So I will give you an example of when this happened. An infamous example of this is the very first episode, the pilot of Veronica Mars. Do you know what I'm going to talk about here?
I do not.
Okay. The very first scene between Veronica and her dad. Veronica, played by Kristen Bell. Enrico Colantoni is her dad, Keith. They come together. They look at each other. Enrico Colantoni scans her face because he's not used to acting with her yet, and she's a very beautiful person. His eyes kind of dart around her face as they're having this very benign conversation, and he ends by staring at her lips, and you're like, whoa, gross, something is wrong here. Now, he modulated that after that, but that's exactly it.
So the place that I went with this was I tried to think of projects that are entirely dependent on us believing the attraction between the two leads, like the whole thing is sunk if we don't buy it. So let's listen to a clip.
So tell me, Gary, what do you do for a living?
Where do you want to go with this?
Not yet. Don't say anything yet.
I don't think it works for somebody else. You know, Gary and Celeste, what do they know about anything?
Well, this is your game I've never played before.
It's not a game. It's not something you play.
Well, does this make any sense to you?
It doesn't have to. It's something that happens. It's like seeing someone for the first time. Like you could be passing on the street and you look at each other, and for a few seconds, there's this kind of a recognition. Like you both know something. The next moment, the person's gone. And it's too late to do anything about it. And you always remember it because it was there, and you let it go. And you think to yourself, what if I had stopped? What if I had said something? What if? What if? It may only happen a few times in your life.
Or once.
That's a good pick.
So some of you will recognize that scene.
That was Made in Manhattan.
Yes. Jennifer Lopez has been in so many films that appeal to my sensibility. But I do love her in Out of Sight. This is Steven Soderbergh's Elmore Leonard adaptation from 1998, a big film that turned his career around, kind of signaled a devotion to quality for Clooney. But this is a love-at-first-sight movie between a career crook, a nonviolent crook, but a crook all the same, and the federal marshal who's chasing after him, and they have to fall for each other instantly as he is abducting her, as he is making his getaway from prison. And there's this long scene where they're trapped in the trunk of her car together, Ving Rhames is driving, and they're talking about old movies. He's misquoting lines from Network and stuff. To what Steven said about sometimes chemistry, you know, just being the product of writing and good direction and acting and all these things. Supposedly, I cannot source this, but IMDb says that the trunk scene Soderbergh wanted 45 takes of.
Wow.
And you can see the like a single, you can see one of those in its 8-minute unedited form on the DVD.
You know, it's funny because, like I said, I am sort of the romance watcher in this group. On the one hand, I agree with Steven that much of what is attributed to chemistry is work, and that it is undoubtedly unfair in many cases to chalk up to chemistry, which of course is a kind of parentless force of nature, which belongs to no one and is the result of nothing real. I also think that although there are some actors where the relationship that they have on camera has a boundary from the relationship that they have off camera, such that, you know, what they're doing is all acting, I also think there are some cases in which the actors either are not as good or they simply choose to rely upon an off-screen relationship or chemistry to make the on-screen thing work. I do believe that there are times, as there are with people in real life, like everybody knows that if you meet certain people, it's fun to be around them together, right? So I do think that's a real thing. And I think there are times when that bleeds through to what you're watching on television or what you're watching on film. The problem is, I don't think you can ever really know for sure which it is in a given situation. And I think people are far too eager to assign that to what the personal relationship is off screen. In other words, I think there are cases where chemistry is coming from the people and the relationship that they have to each other, but it's hard to tell when that is. And I'm not sure that there aren't times when chemistry really is, as a real thing, is actually good collaborating, where those two people are really good at working together. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean they're actually attracted to each other, or it might not mean that, or it means that plus something else. It just means that they're good at acting together. They're good at working together. I was only partially kidding when I kind of related this entire concept of chemistry to making this show, in the sense that there are people who you get them in conversation with each other and it's really fun and cool and you think, oh yeah, it would be great to have this person and that person together. And there are combinations that work better than other ones for reasons that are kind of hard to pin down. So I do believe in something kind of...
You're saying that Chris is dead weight. No, I agree.
What? Sorry?
Yes, you put your finger right on it.
It's often because the film or the television show is elbowing you in the ribs to say, oh, what's going to happen when these guys get together?
Sure.
Like, for example, the movie Heat. I know you love it, Chris. When Pacino and De Niro get together, you know they're going to get together. You know what's going to happen. And when they do, it's electric because you've been waiting for it for so long. Similarly, on the show Justified, when Raylan Givens and Boyd Crowder come together in a scene, that's what the show's about. And you know that's what the show's about. And even though the show is a hell of a lot of fun, those scenes make everything crackle. And that is as much to do with the writing as it is to do with the way these two actors look at each other. I tell you.
I think TV in particular has to sort of use the Venn diagram where you have different kinds of chemistry kind of bleeding into one another, just because it has to sustain that tension over a longer period, where you have, you know, the Boyd and Raylan, it's adversarial chemistry. There's more friction because they were friends at one time. They dug coal together.
I think that it is important, kind of the flip side of what I said at the beginning of this segment, though, to not automatically assume that bad on-screen chemistry is the product of these people not having chemistry. Like, when you think about, like, classic examples of on-screen couples who have no chemistry, one that comes up a lot is in the Star Wars prequels with Natalie Portman Hayden Christensen, is a legendarily, they are just like two volleyballs bouncing off each other. I think that's a Linda Holmesism I stole. But there's
those sibling horn dogs, Luke and Leia, meanwhile. Yeah.
There's nothing going on there. But when you think about it, first of all, you have George Lucas, who is not necessarily known for directing dialogue.
He's not an actor's director.
He's not an actor's director. In a movie with a lot of green screen and a lot of, you know, I don't know exactly what the settings were in which their characters took place, but you often have people who are expected to show chemistry and interaction with people who are not even necessarily in the room with them.
Right.
If there was a way for me to avoid what I'm about to do, I would do it. But, oh my God, I'm going to talk about Dawson's Creek. Okay. And here is why. For me, one of the arguments in favor of chemistry being a real thing that really exists sometimes in spite of writing and kind of creative work that's not necessarily in search of it, is that every now and then you will see, particularly on television, where you are having an evolving product, where they can decide to pursue things or not pursue things, depending on how they're working. There are cases in which the original conceit of the show is that X and Y are a romantic couple. But over the course of the show, people become interested in something else, sometimes in spite of what the writers think that they're writing.
Right.
And that is the story of Dawson's Creek. And I can't bear to get any more specific about it than that because I will reveal, I don't know, having feelings about it. But my point is only
no feelings.
That anyone who saw that show knows, I think, that over the course of the show, the kind of central idea of what that show was about shifted from one couple to another couple, shifted from A and B are supposed to be together and C's the friend to B and C are supposed to be together and A's the friend. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and I think that happened in part because of how fun it was to watch actors together who weren't originally intended to be a couple. But when you watched them, it was kind of like, and it was more fun than anything else on the show. And it partly has to do with people who have a lot of charisma, who show up on screen, and maybe it's not just the way they work with each other. Maybe it's the kind of charisma that they have on the show. But there are other examples in television. This is not just a point about Dawson's Creek. There are other examples.
Only ever happened, Dawson's Creek.
There are other examples in television where something that was not intended to be a couple or a pairing. I think The Big Bang Theory wound up doing a lot more work with Sheldon and Penny together because people liked them together so much and because their scenes were much funnier than necessarily people thought they were going to be. So from the beginning, they've really kind of looked for opportunities to do big episodes with those two together, even though they weren't necessarily originally the most obvious scene partners. I do think that when you look at a show that evolves over time to accommodate the strengths and weaknesses of different combinations of actors working together, you see kind of at least some support for this theory that certain people just work together even when it's not what you think you're creating.
My favorite TV show ever is The Avengers, the British Avengers, the spy series from the 60s. And this is an interesting test case in chemistry because over the course of the 9 years that this show aired, it didn't start getting imported to the U.S. until about halfway through that run. But Patrick McNee, who is the constant, is paired with a succession of partners. There are like three at first who no one remembers. And then you get Honor Blackman as Mrs. Gale. And it becomes this very progressive, you know, equal contributor, male, female. In 1964, I think, you know, spy partnership. She leaves to go be in Goldfinger. And then Diana Rigg comes along. And this is really the era of the show. One, you know, people know it more over here because it started being shown in the U.S. at this time. But she leaves. He gets another partner. And the show takes a real dip.
Yeah.
You know, so just the opportunity to see him with all of these other foils kind of illustrates how important that chemistry is.
Yeah. And I think there's a difference between chemistry exists and is a thing in terms of people's ability to work together, and chemistry exists and is a thing and means that there is a transparency between if people are sexy to watch together, it means that they're literally attracted to each other as actors, and if not, then not, which is kind of what Stephen is saying, that it doesn't translate that directly.
I mean, getting back to the point about 50 Shades of Grey and the stars of that movie reportedly not getting along, I mean, one of the examples that I brought up when we were originally brainstorming this idea was the movie Some Like It Hot with Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe, who legendarily hated each other. And Tony Curtis, to the point where...
Again, allegedly.
Allegedly, but it's a pretty widely reported story that he would like chew
it's
garlic.
It's in Roger Moore's book.
No less an authority.
No less an authority than Sir Roger Moore.
But that Tony Curtis like chewed garlic before scenes in which he kissed her just in order to irritate her, in order to just put one over on her as somebody he genuinely disliked. Mm. And now, granted, I mean, saying they have great chemistry in that movie is a little bit of a misnomer because you're not talking about an era of supernaturalistic acting. It's not necessary for them to spark off each other in quite such a naturalistic way that you would have to have today. There's much more of that stentorian acting, even though...
Eddie Redmayne is the master of supernaturalistic acting. Go ahead.
You finally came up with a term for what Eddie Redmayne does in that movie.
Go ahead, sorry.
I mean, that's a great movie. That's a funny movie. It is a romantic movie in its own goofy way. And yet, that is a classic case of actors who despise each other. And they're not necessarily, it's not like they hate each other, so there's this kind of rough energy to them.
Right.
It's just hidden.
Yeah. I mean, there are stories about lots and lots and lots of film couples who allegedly hated each other, and TV couples who hate each other, which I wouldn't list even if I wanted to, because I don't want to break the hearts of the people who like them and maybe haven't heard those rumors.
Amy Poehler and Tina Fey cannot be
together. That's right. They detest
each other. That is not true. He is lying. Do not believe him.
Flying fists.
Yeah, do not believe him. Once again, you know, come and find us and tell us what you think about romantic chemistry and other kinds of chemistry. We are all about chemistry. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen, what is making you happy this week?
I took a break from preparing for the Austin 100 by listening to the new album coming out in late March by an Australian singer named Courtney Barnett. We featured her on NPR Music a number of times. She's played a Tiny Desk concert, and the way we got to know her music was in these early singles that are very shambling and very conversational, and she would seem to be experiencing almost like just a stream of consciousness, you know, these anecdotes in song form. Very, very charming, very fun and funny and light. And she's got this record coming out. This is her first official full-length album called Sometimes I Sit and Think and Sometimes I Just Sit. It's a rock and roll record. It's so good. It's going to be one of my favorite albums of the year. And the first single is floating around, and it is so awesome. It's called Pedestrian at Best. Jessica, hit me. So this song builds and builds and builds until it almost comes completely unhinged at the end. It is just a fabulous rock and roll song that still retains her ability to craft wordplay. I just love it, Courtney Barnett.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Hit me one time, Jessica Reedy.
One time, Dorothy Gish was visiting me on the set of Little Nettie, Grab Your Gun. And she came up to me, and she looked me in the face, and I'd never met her. I'd just known her from the films, you know, Dorothy Gish, Lillian's sister. And she looked me in the eyes, and she said, "Young man, you have got it." And, Dorothy Gish. It's a true story.
That is a scene from Three Amigos, the 1986 film starring Martin Short, Steve Martin, and Chevy Chase. In that scene, he is one of the three amigos who's been brought down to a Mexican town. He is actually a Hollywood actor in silent films, and the town around him thinks that he's actually a vigilante, and he is telling the story to a group of nonplussed Mexican women who probably don't understand his what he's saying and certainly have never heard of Dorothy Gish, sister of Lillian. That scene was completely improvised and was almost cut from the film. The studio thought it was too loose, too improv-y, too weird, and would go over the heads of the audience. And John Landis fought for it, and it stayed in. I learned that because I have just finished listening to the audiobook of Martin Short's newish showbiz memoir called I Must Say, My Life as a Humble Comedy Legend. This is one of the most knowing and playful showbiz memoirs I've ever come across, because he is such a fan of that schmaltzy 50s, mid-century, Vegas-y showbiz that when he has to tell a story that is actually legitimately moving, like about the death of his brother or the death of his wife, he knows to modulate. He is such a fan of being able to adjust his tone, and he sincerely loves the showbiz qualities, and he knows what he's doing when he's telling us a story about vacationing in St. Bart's with Steve Martin and Tom Hanks. He knows what that sounds like, and he plays with that. It's just so smart about what it's doing. It's entertaining. I recommend the audiobook. I mean, when you have a performer
right.
reading their own book, especially one that does as many voices as this guy does, I mean, what's... Sure, read the book. But the audiobook is really worth it. It's, I must say, my life as a humble comedy legend by Martin Short.
Wonderful. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
Justified is back. Justified has begun its final season, the Raylan Boyd confrontation that we've been waiting for. My viewing club, the Justified Society of America, of which I'm the only male member, has reconvened. But also Agent Carter.
Agent Carter.
I only watched like two episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and thought, okay, don't really need to pay attention to this.
Nope.
But I love Agent Carter. It's Stephen Marcus and Christopher McFeely, I think, the two writers who did the two Captain America films. Unlikely, but they are my favorite Marvel movies, I think. This is set in 1946. It's the precursor organization to S.H.I.E.L.D. with Hayley Atwell reprising her role as Peggy Carter, Captain America's, I guess, unconsummated love
right.
interest from mm-hmm. the first movie. She is as capable as any of her male counterparts, but they tell her to get the coffee and answer the phone, so she's doing their jobs for them and also enduring their disrespect. In the second episode, I'm just going to spoil this thing because I love old-time radio shows, she suffers the indignity of having to, every time she gets in the car, she's in a public place, hear the Captain America radio show within the show, wherein she individually is depicted as a helpless, breathy, you know, woman in need of rescue. And they intercut a scene of the actors in the studio performing the Captain America radio show where she's, oh, help me, save me, Captain America. And the dude is breaking like lobster claws and stuff to create punching sound effects. While intercut with that, the real Peggy Carter is beating the crap out of some Nazi or something.
It's pretty
That's
great.
Agent Carter. It's
That's
great.
Cool.
It's
really
pretty great.
Cool. Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. If you are listening to this podcast on the Friday that we release it, then tonight I will be at the Smithsonian talking to BJ Novak. Now, some of you know that I did a Smithsonian event with Shonda Rhimes back in the fall. This is a similar event, but it is BJ Novak, who you may know from The Office or from being on The Mindy Project or from being in a variety of movies or writing a couple of books. He had a book that was out in 2014 called One More Thing, Stories and Other Stories. And it's the kind of book that could be insufferable. It is a young comic writer doing a bunch of little vignettes and playing around quite a bit with form. Some of them are only a couple few lines. Some of them are short story length. I am currently, I think about halfway through, Glenn was just recommending the audiobook. And in this particular audiobook, he reads most of these stories himself, but he also has some appearances from other people when it seems most important to the story to have another voice in the story. So Jenna Fischer is in it, Rainn Wilson is in it, but Lena Dunham is in it. And the first one that really, really kind of punched me in the gut is a story about a guy who orders a sex robot and it falls in love with him. Now, that sounds like the kind of thing, it's like, I got this story about a guy whose sex robot falls in love with him. It just sounds like it's so kind of facile. You know, it sounds from the description like it could be not much. Lena Dunham, in the audiobook, is the voice of the sex robot. It is the most affecting, sad, interesting, thoughtful thing. It really caught me off guard. It's really quite touching. And there are also a bunch of them that are really funny. There's a really funny one called Closure where Mindy Kaling plays a woman who keeps wanting to meet up with her boyfriend so she can get closure. And she finally persuades him to talk to her. And then various, very odd things happen because clearly this is a dude who does not believe, BJ Novak, I mean, as the writer, does not entirely believe in closure. And so what you get from this is a lot of philosophy of relationships and philosophy of life. And it really has impressed me. And some of these stories are really quite sweet. So I recommend that book if you haven't sought it out. One More Thing stories and other stories by BJ Novak. Nice. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C and Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon and Chris at CT Klimek and our producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. And don't forget, you can follow this entire podcast at NPR PCHH. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. What if MacGyver worked at NPR? He kinda does. Check out the How to Do Everything podcast with Mike and Ian. When you need to know how to find a date or find water in the desert, Mike and Ian are here for you. How to Do Everything is modern life lessons from NPR. Find How to Do Everything now at iTunes.com/NPR.